Hi, this is Jen, and welcome to the latest episode of Minorities in Publishing podcast. If you're new or a recurring listener, you know that the podcast is on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and also on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. So I'm really psyched to introduce Mecca Jamila Sullivan, and it's really kind of funny because we've known each other for 7 years.
Wow, that's right.
Yeah, we met in Ghana. The country.
Right.
At, what was it? The Pan-African Literary Forum.
Right.
Yeah, in Accra, Ghana. And this was 7 years ago. And I remember you just had a very great energy about you. Very kind. Very, you know, even though we're all sweating.
Right.
Hot. We're in a foreign country.
Right.
Some of us are sick. You were just came in smiling, well put together.
Thank you, Jen. Well, likewise, definitely. I think, you know, right away I was like, okay, this person is someone I want to talk to.
And your mom was there. I remember your mom came too.
Oh, yes, she was. Don't you know, yes, I'm going to South Africa in a couple of weeks. And, of course, my mother's first question was, well, when am I coming? Yes, but shout out to my mom. It was great to have her there.
So it's been so wonderful to see everything, that all the success that you've had. Seeing that story that you worked on at PAL get published widely. And also your story collection, Blue Talk and Love, come out earlier this year. And you got your doctorate, your assistant professor, you know, just lots going on.
It's true. It's true. It's been a busy 8 years, 7 years, but productive, definitely.
Yeah. So I'm a huge, huge fan of Blue Talk and Love.
It's fantastic.
There's not one story where I didn't connect. And I don't think you can say that a lot about... I'm a fan of anthologies.
Sure.
I don't know that people can always say that about anthologies. Because even with something like The Goon Squad, people are like, well, that other story, you know?
Right. No, that means a lot to me. And it's great to hear. Because even as you're putting a collection together, you're thinking, okay, you know, which stories are going to connect with the greatest number of people? Which stories are going to connect with whom? So it's great to hear that you found something in all of the stories that spoke to you.
So definitely... Listeners, Blue Talk and Love, Mecca Jamila Sullivan. Get that immediately. Paperback, so reasonably priced.
Yes.
Go to your indie preferably, but if not, Amazon.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
So, for those who listen all the time, you know what the first question is going to be at this point. And it's, where did it begin?
Yes.
Because you're not just a writer, you're an editor.
Right.
And you're a professor.
Right.
And all these are such... They're so distinctive, but they really do work together, I feel like, in terms of creating the written word and working with people and learning about the human condition, which is a lot of what... Your stories are very character-based.
Right.
Character-driven, about environment, and we'll talk about more about the body as well.
Right.
So where did it begin for you as a writer and editor, and what sparked your need to be affiliated with the written word?
Right. It's a great question, and I love the framing of that question, sort of... Trying to think of the place, you know, the place in my life or sort of, you know, the place in my development where that happened. And I would say, actually, the same year that I went to Nigeria with my mother, I was 11 years old, the fifth grade.
Oh, wow.
Was, you know, just one of those years where I was having a whole lot of just new kind of, culture, you know, experiences, right? Traveling abroad for more or less the first time. That same year, I discovered Ntozake Shange's For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide,
oh,
When the Rain Was Enough. I also discovered Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye.
At 11?
At 11. And, you know, in a certain way, I had no business reading either of those books. I'm glad I did, though. And I mean, you know, of course, I didn't understand them, you know, at least not in the way that I would understand them later on in my life. But I think those two books really kind of opened my eyes to the possibility of a writing life. You know, sort of a moment where I realized, okay, people do this. You know, people create worlds, create characters, create stories and narratives. And like, that's a choice that I can make for my life. I could make my life about doing that. And, you know, both of these books are books about Black women in particular. And that was just huge for me. And in fact, although I was, you know, too young perhaps to be really reading those books, they were about, in many ways, Black girlhood and Black growing up. And so feeling reflected and kind of seeing myself reflected meant a lot to me. and was just totally inspiring, you know. And in terms of the editing, so I'm associate editor for arts and culture at the Feminist Wire. And, you know, that when that opportunity came to me, it was a no-brainer because realizing just sort of how important my own relationship with writing is and how much I get from the, you know, the opportunity to share my writing with readers who will find connections, you know, when having those conversations where someone says, like, I got what you were doing with that. It meant something to me. That's so gratifying that the opportunity to facilitate that experience for other writers was something that, you know, was invaluable to me. And I sort of felt right away, like, that's what I want to do. I love the work that I do for Feminist Wire because I get to kind of, you know, help writers find exposure and help writers and audiences and writers and readers find one another, which is just really cool and a lot of fun.
It was funny because in an earlier episode from this year with Cynthia Manick, who's a poet, and she also has Jammy Publishing, and we're talking about when you're, especially when you're a person of color and you're an artist, especially, so you know what the rejection side feels like. How is that for you? Do you feel like you need to put in even extra effort in terms of, let me water it down or really coddle the artist in this or are you able to really flip that switch as I'm editor now? And it's just needs form letter, get it to where it needs to be. Or I really see how personal it is, but it's not personal. Like the art of being accepted, rejected is not necessarily a personal thing.
That's hard. I mean, at first I was writing long, long, you know, first of all, I couldn't even call them rejection letters. I call them decline letters. And I was writing these long decline letters with notes and page numbers and, you know, look at this line and rethink this. And of course, you know, when I started a tenure track position, that became impossible. And even before then, it really was not sustainable. And so I did start to kind of, you know, distance myself in one way. You know, I became more comfortable with the form letter. But what I did on the other side was I really kind of made a point of investing in those submissions that were kind of on the line, submissions that I thought really had some potential. And I, and so anyone who's gotten a rejection or a decline letter from me, there's always a note. If, you know, if the, you know, our board of readers has found something of value, I make sure that I let the writer know. And then often, you know, I'll invite a resubmission. I give my personal email and I say, you know, you can send to me directly and we can talk more about whether this piece, you know, whether there's a way to develop this piece for resubmission. Either to the Feminist Wire, or if we find that it's just not for us, at least that feedback is something you can take elsewhere. So, you know, I spend less time on most of the submissions, but the one, I do kind of try to pay attention to the ones where I find there's potential that's perhaps just not fully developed, you know?
And how essential do you think that is in terms of giving somethings, a little nugget of, I see what you're doing here, it's not for us, but...
I mean, it was huge for me, you know, when I first started. And some of these same stories in Blue Talk and Love, you know, got rejected, you know, 5-6 times. And I think it really was, you know, having some of those kind of narrative, even just the two handwritten lines, you know, behind at the end of the rejection letter, sort of, this is great, just not for us, or we really love your voice. It meant a lot to me. And there were times, especially when I was in graduate school and I was, you know, and I was, it was a, it's a PhD program in English literature. So fiction wasn't part of my, my PhD training. So it really was time that I was taking and investing in my fiction. Having those little moments of affirmation and encouragement was huge for me. And I realized that, you know, again, if I can provide that for other writers, I know what it means. It sound, it might sound cheesy or whatever, but it's also very real, right? Like having... Some days you need to have someone say, what you're doing is worthwhile and you should keep doing it.
You know? Because I feel the same way when I get those rejections that are, we really did appreciate this, or we were kind of split on the decision, but give us something else. You just keep that note and say, okay, well, I'm on the right track. Because it's so much, I feel like the artistry is so much about, I'm just like, self-aggrandizement in a way. It's like looking in the mirror, I'm pretty. I know I'm good. I'm talented. I know
that kind of self-affirmation. It's true. And sometimes you get to the point where you're like, well, am I the only one that thinks this? You know? And so having those outside voices,
yeah,
it really does mean a lot.
Yeah.
And it's worth it. And, you know, when you think about sort of, you know, a cost-benefit analysis, my taking the time to write two lines to a writer who I really do believe in, you know, it's relatively little, you know, expense or expenditure for me, and it could mean so much to that person, and it could contribute to more good writing in the world,
yes,
you know, and
yeah,
maybe more good writing in my magazine, and that's what I want, and so, you know, it ends up being worth it.
I remember seeing on Twitter, I don't know if it was recently or a few weeks ago, that someone, I say diverse, and I know I can continually repeat that I know that people don't like the word diverse, because
sure,
Anna Holmes also recently did an article on does diversity lost its meaning,
right,
and she said, you know, there's what's the point?
Mm.
She kept getting rejections, and maybe there were form rejections. I don't know the level of that, but she in particular felt that people didn't want to hear her story, and her story was also about diverse people that was connected to her truth. And it really is heartbreaking to hear that, because also social media is a vulnerable place too.
Yeah.
That's where kind of people just put it out there. And, you know, I know Roxane Gay is very, you know, she reveals herself. I think that's part of why people really appreciate what she has to say.
Yeah.
So when I see things like that, I'm wondering if it's the lack of that little push, or it's not having built the skin yet of what a writer, being an artist is.
Sure.
But also this the negativity that is essentially tied to being an other.
Right.
I'm using quotation marks when I say other.
Right.
Like, you know. So it is, I think it is great to hear that.
Yeah.
And also encourage artists to build that skin and look in the mirror and self-affirmations and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, on a certain level, it's like the world we live in does not affirm us, our voices, our stories. And when I say us, I'm talking about a whole lot of people, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's one of the kind of conflicts with the term like diversity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really there are many, many, many people whose voices are just not affirmed. But speaking from my location as a Black queer woman, you know, of size, in fact, right? Like my story is not a story that I see affirmed in the media or even in, you know, sort of what we might think of as the American literary canon, with a few exceptions, you know what I mean? And so, again, for me, it's very much about a kind of, almost like a kind of one-on-one communication between, you know, author and reader, or between, you know, text and reader, where I know what texts have spoken to me, and I know what that conversation has done for me in my life, you know what I mean? And so the opportunity to participate in that from the other side and just sort of put a story out there for either some big Black girl elsewhere who needs to read the story, or for any reader who really needs to better understand that experience. And of course, I argue that, as you've said, it's a human experience, right? And we really all should be able to kind of benefit from and enjoy coming into contact with the experiences of people who are different from us.
Yes.
You know, and that's what the best readers do. Unfortunately, we don't always train, you know, young folks to be great readers.
No, we don't.
You know, and it's a huge problem.
The analytical aspect of reading is so narrow that I've been reflecting on and doing more panels too. Is, and I'm sure as an educator, you know, of what we're fed.
Mm-hmm.
In high school especially, because I remember Tayemba just posted something about on Facebook. He was saying, how many of you have had Black male educators?
Right.
I said, oh my God.
Right.
I can count on one hand how many Black male educators I've had.
Sure.
And definitely not in the English realm.
Interesting.
And that sounds, you know, definitely not in the literature realm.
Right.
It's usually been Caucasian people teaching me how to read literature, which is a very distinctive way of looking. Where you're looking at Chaucer is the canon.
Exactly.
You know, Shakespeare is the canon.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You know, Steinbeck, who I love, is part of the canon.
Right.
So it's, you know, it is very distinctive of how it starts and keeps going, even into the graduate, postgraduate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, I've been fortunate enough to have well, to have a number of really great professors and educators in my life, you know, and some of whom have been Black men,
mm-hmm.
and mentors. I mean, so one of my mentors in my PhD program, Herman Beavers, who's a poet,
mm-hmm.
fantastic teacher, and, you know, he and the rest of my committee were really kind of instructive, not only in terms of helping me to work through my dissertation research, but also to kind of understand myself as a teacher and figure out what kind of presence I wanted to have in the classroom and how to kind of work against, you know, how to rethink the idea
yeah.
of the canon, how to kind of, and how to encourage students to think critically. And I've also been fortunate enough to have sort of critically minded and you know, sort of sharp,
mm-hmm.
astute, critical thinking students who are at least, who are always sort of willing to get in there and ask
mm-hmm.
those questions, you know.
Awesome.
It's something that comes, I think, from teaching not only in English departments, but teaching English courses that are connected with women, gender, and sexuality studies
mm-hmm.
and Africana studies. The students who find their ways
mm-hmm.
to those classrooms, I think, come with at least a kind of curiosity about
mm-hmm.
critical discourse and critical thinking. And it's very, you know, it's really gratifying to then give them tools
mm-hmm.
to develop some of those curiosities that they come in with.
Awesome.
Yeah.
The MFA versus non-MFA debate that continually goes on. And I think it was Juno.
Mm-hmm.
I think Daniel Jose Older and Juno Diaz keep getting mixed up when
right.
people talk about...
Right.
Yeah.
POC, yes.
So I think it was Juno. Yeah, it was Juno. He spoke about being POC specifically
right.
in the MFA program, and this kind of encouraged this debate of, well, do we need it? Do we need only POC? You know, this is where things like VONAR are so essential,
right.
like Cambilio and, you know, Cave Canem,
right.
things like that, that have been established and are newly established as well. And when it comes to marginalized voices, the question is, why put yourself in a community where you may very well be a bigger minority?
Right.
Than in the world you already reside in. So having a doctorate,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there's a biased opinion, do you feel that the MFA is necessary? And do you feel like there's a certain outcome that should be considered when you pursue graduate study, particularly as a writer,
mm-hmm.
not just as a person who wants to pursue education
right.
and be an instructor or professor,
right.
get on the tenure track, but as a writer?
Right.
Do you feel like it's necessary? Do you feel like it's worth it? Or?
Right. So my story is interesting in that before I started the PhD program, I did a master's in creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an MA rather than an MFA. Although I did the master's in creative writing and fiction at Temple University.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that degree has since converted to an MFA. So, and the structure
mm-hmm.
was very much like an MFA program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the way the program was set up, we were taking workshops, we had tutorials, but we also took literature courses with the PhD students. And in many ways, that's kind of how I ended up in the PhD. I realized that I really enjoyed the lit courses as much as I enjoyed the
mm-hmm.
workshops in different ways, but that there was something of interest there for me. So in some ways, I have both experiences. I have
mm-hmm.
the MFA experience and I have the PhD experience. What I don't have is the kind of, you know, sort of being outside of the institution and doing the work of creating community and creating literature
mm-hmm.
outside of academia.
Mm.
But what I can say based on my experience is that, you know, those years doing the master's in creative writing were actually very helpful to me for a few reasons. The mentorship, you know, I worked with Samuel Delaney and Joan
oh,
Bellet.
Wow.
You know, I got just really fantastic mentorship, you know, a great cohort of writers and peers
mm-hmm.
and, you know, a lot of, and honestly, just the opportunity to spend 2 years focusing on my fiction was huge. You
mm-hmm.
know, I was fortunate enough to have a teaching fellowship. So,
mm.
you know, I also got to develop as a teacher, you know, and kind of think about my pedagogy. And those years were hugely
mm-hmm.
formative for me for lots of reasons, you know, including that I was able to produce drafts there. That then when I needed those moments of affirmation down the line, when I had started the PhD program, you know, which could have been when I started a job or whatever, when I wasn't able to focus on my writing in the same way, I had drafts that I could revise and send out. And so even when I didn't have time to write, I was able to revise and publish. And that was the thing that kind of kept me going
okay.
as a writer.
Yeah.
So when I really think about it, I don't think that my fiction would be where it is if not for the MFA program. But again, that's only my experience. And, I mean, absolutely, you know, the MFA versus POC conversation, I think, you know, we've all been in workshops where people misread your work, where people misunderstand what you're doing with your work, or, you know, on the flip side, where the kind of failure to value the stories that you're telling mean that people don't engage your work and don't give you the kind of feedback that you need. Or people just say crazy, racist, sexist, homophobic stuff in workshops. Mm-hmm. And then it falls on you to do the educating, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, it's draining, it's violent, or can be.
Mm-hmm.
And it can really, it can taint your relationship to your degree and sometimes to your writing, you know? And I've known of plenty of people who felt like they had to kind of step back from workshop, which sometimes means stepping back from their writing to kind of heal from some of the violent and, you know, kind of traumatic things that happen in the workshop space. But I think you put your finger on, I think part of the issue is about who's leading the workshops, right?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
And, I, you know, I don't know, if, when you, for me, teaching creative writing is a great opportunity to model how to effectively lead a workshop that doesn't traumatize all the people of color in the class. You know what I mean? Like, calling people on their stuff when they say things about race that don't make sense and that are, again, traumatizing and violent.
Mm-hmm.
It's the instructor's job.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, sometimes not only does that not happen, but the instructor themselves may not have a critical race consciousness that they can bring to the table. And so, students of color end up just being completely vulnerable.
Yeah, and blindsided.
Yes.
I feel like,
you
know.
Yeah. And then you have those moments where, especially as you said, if you're the only one, you know, it's all of that sense of sort of no one is really understanding that you are experiencing. No one's believing in your experience.
Mm-hmm.
So a good friend of mine, Nina Sharma, has this fantastic essay where she's talking about this same issue, this experience of being a person of color in the workshop space. And, you know, she talks about sort of this refrain, this question that people are continually asking, well, is it really that bad? Are you really experiencing this? And it's a gorgeous essay because, of course, as a great writer does, she uses that kind of repetition of really to kind of reinforce just the level of skepticism, disbelief, and, you know, silencing that can happen in some of these spaces. I think it's very real. At the same time, I think, you know, there can be benefits to the degree, but at the end of the day, you know, I think it really does come down to sort of what a cost-benefit analysis, again, and sort of what choices you want to make for your career, what you're willing to deal with, what you can change, what and also, like, strategies for just kind of self-healing, the skin that you were talking about earlier. I tend to think of it not so much as sort of developing a thick skin, because I believe that we have a right to be vulnerable and sensitive, and that's part of humanity, too. But I think developing strategies for coping and dealing. And sometimes those strategies are leaving. You know, like sometimes the strategy is to say, this is ridiculous and I'm out. But other times there are other ways to kind of get something from whatever environment that you're in.
Yeah.
And, you know, leave the rest, find your voice, take care of yourself.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Self-soothing techniques, as I like to call it.
Exactly. And like, I really think that some of those, there doesn't have to be a kind of binary distinction between self-soothing and, like, agitating. You know what I mean? You can soothe yourself and make a real critique at the same time.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be taking, you know, taking your hurt feelings elsewhere and licking your wounds, right? Like, you know, you can scream and shout and yell and then go heal yourself, and both are completely okay.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because the word sensitivity is used a lot, which is starting to, you know, become ingrained and also annoy the crap out of me personally. And Sarah Zarr, who's a really great YA author, she was talking about that and talking about how, you know, she gets called sensitive. And then she just adopted, you know, I guess I'm being sensitive. As a woman, women are sensitive. Where I guess I'm just being sensitive. But then also acknowledging and realizing that she said she was being hypervigilant because she had been hurt. So she's being, you know, she's putting up the caution, you know, it's just like, whoa, 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 am I going to get hurt again? Is there a way for me to just be, make sure that this doesn't happen again? And that's not necessarily sensitivity and
Right.
How quickly people just say, you're being sensitive to my critique, especially as POCs or LGBTQ people who are disabled, religious minorities, and so on, when you get those critiques.
Right.
Like you're saying, is it really true? You're just being too sensitive. Why are you so angry?
Right.
And I liked what Sarah said was, no, I'm being hypervigilant because I don't want to get hurt right now.
Right.
So I'm gonna stand up and I'm gonna say that this is not okay and da 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 da.
Right.
So I'm gonna use the word hypervigilance from now on.
Yeah. And it may not even be, you know, sort of hypervigilant. It may not even be excessively vigilant, right?
Yeah.
It could be completely appropriate, just being as vigilant as you need to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's in a certain sense, it's sort of course that's what it is, right? I mean, we're reacting to real phenomena, real factors in our lives. Technical kind of material experiences, actual things that are happening to us, whether those things are acknowledged or not.
Yeah.
You know?
Or seen. That's I think that's a big thing you also hear is, well, I didn't see it.
Exactly.
I didn't, you know, I don't know. That may be your truth.
Right.
But
it's not
I have
truth.
It. Yeah.
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 Right.
And then that becomes a whole bigger discussion with, especially when it comes to us being othered.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Who gets to tell the story?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, pretty ironic when we're talking about a workshop stage, right? Where it's like, well, I wrote the story. This is, if there's any time for my truth to matter, it should be in a creative writing workshop space.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
If not, why are we here? Why are we calling ourselves writers?
Exactly. Exactly. So speaking of writing,
yes.
we get to talk about your book again, which I'm very excited for.
All right.
So in your collection, Blue Talk and Love, I felt that there's the thematic element in which the body is often referenced or the focus of your stories.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout, it's a connective thread. And in Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, which is nominated for a National Book Award, and by the time this airs, might have won one, he leads off. Like, one of the first things he acknowledges in the first chapter is the Black body and how it's been enslaved and how we see it on TV now at an astonishingly excessive rate, I feel like, being, you know, recently the girl at high school being thrown by that security or the cop, and the deaths and shootings and Sandra Bland and so forth, of how the Black body is just treated just so violently by others. And also, this has been the state of the Black body in particular throughout history. So do you feel, as a woman of color in particular, that this is an awareness that you are never allowed to lose sight of, or that you just never have lost sight of?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really interesting question, and it's an interesting, you know, way of kind of thinking about it. Definitely the body is, you know, it's a way, for me, it's a way into characters' experience. Mm-hmm. And so it's highlighted, I mean, in the collection, there are all kinds of bodies, all kinds of sort of different bodies, from, you know, the big Black girl characters that I've talked about to characters who are, you know, experiencing certain kinds of hunger, sort of physical hunger, who are very much aware of that. There's a story about conjoined twins that, you know, there's a kind of focus on what that experience of the body and Black bodies is like. And I do think definitely, you know, as a Black woman, Black women's bodies in this country, but in the diaspora, have been historically seen as, you know, sexually available, as sort of implements of labor and producers of labor and of, you know, culture in various ways.
And caretakers.
Absolutely.
Most often
which
caretakers.
I see as a form of labor, right, in a way. Sort of the body is constantly available to others, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think a lot of Black literary discourse talks about what that means and how that ends up actually affirming whiteness and then sort of empowers whiteness to be more than just the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if Black folks are seen as sort of constantly related only to the body, then the realm of the intellect, the imagination, emotion, right, all of that that we associate with humanity is not associated with Black bodies and instead is associated with, not to impose a binary, but you know, it's the sort of empowered forms and visions of whiteness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Blackness is the labor, Blackness is the sexuality, Blackness is the body, and whiteness is the intellect, the imagination. And so for me, I'm really interested in, you know, kind of disturbing that, right? And that's why I'm thinking constantly about the body, but I'm also thinking about how Black women's sort of inner lives function within their bodies, how Black women experience our bodies,
mm-hmm.
and how we're thinking about our bodies, how we're imagining our bodies, how we're... So in other words, it's, you know, I'm looking at sort of how Black women's bodies can be defined by Black women, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to how they're defined externally.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, there's something, first of all, it's just, you know, I'm really interested in that conversation because, as you said, we don't really see those views of Black women's bodies
mm-hmm.
that often. But at the same time, we don't see that often, you know, sort of experiences of Black women's fantasy lives, Black women's imaginative lives, Black
mm-hmm.
women's, even Black women's sensuality from a kind of interior perspective, we don't get a lot
mm-hmm.
of. And I'm speaking not only just in terms of sort of the media, right,
mm-hmm.
and kind of mass media and popular culture, but even in the literary canon, because the literary
mm-hmm.
canon has tended to exclude Black women, right? So
mm-hmm.
there's a very limited array of Black women's experiences of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, in some ways that sort of limits our understandings of Black women's characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't have a character that's walking around not aware of their body, especially if this character is a Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
We walk around, I mean, I was just at a meeting today, very kind of fancy, you know, office building down
mm-hmm.
in the financial district, and I'm with a bunch of colleagues, and I'm the only Black woman, and, you know, it's a Saturday, we're clearly doing work of some kind on a, you know, an off day. Everyone is dressed in business attire. And there are two people, doing some kind of building work in this space. And I'm, you know, walking through with all of these colleagues, and someone says, you know, greeting everyone else, oh, hi, how are you doing today? How are you doing today? To me, oh, you look good. And, you
wow.
know, it's one of these moments where I'm sort of ripped out of my professional experience, right,
mm-hmm.
that I'm having. I'm here making very important decisions about a professional organization that I'm a part of. And part of, you know, I'm taking part in, you know, kind of very important, you know, conversations. And I'm ripped out of my intellectual space, right, ripped out of my professional
mm-hmm.
space and reduced to body parts.
Mm.
And we know this as women of color walking around, that this can happen at any moment,
mm-hmm.
right? Our bodies are constantly hailed and defined by other people.
Mm-hmm.
To me as a writer, what I want to show is sort of, what I want to explore is how we experience our own bodies and how
mm-hmm.
our bodies can, how our experiences of our bodies can really kind of speak to who we are as individuals,
mm-hmm.
how we see ourselves, you know, the complexity of our
mm-hmm.
subjectivity, the complexity of our experience.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Been there.
Yeah. I know you have. It's like comes out of nowhere. You could be just doing any old thing and somebody
yeah.
will just remind you that by some external standards, all you are is a body.
Yeah. And what I love about Ta-Nehisi's book is how he just said the body.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone, it's funny how in interviews people were so curious. Well, why do you refer to the body? You know, even
mm-hmm.
Gayle King, who I have my own comments about
sure.
on CBS this morning. Well, why the body,
right.
Ta-Nehisi? Why the body? Why
yeah.
the body? And for him, he's saying it's obvious
because
mm-hmm. that's what you see. We are reduced, like you said,
mm-hmm.
to bodies.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we are. We aren't intellectuals. We aren't. This is our bare bones, what we are seen as
mm-hmm.
in society every day. So it's interesting that. Also, it wasn't until he said something that people said, wow,
right.
I never thought about
sure.
it that way.
I mean, and this is the way, like, pop culture discourse works. I guess, I mean, Black scholars have been writing about Black bodies and
yes.
Black embodiment for
yes.
decades, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can even think about how, you know, as you pointed out, and as he points out, sort of this is a discourse that begins in slavery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
There's not a single slave narrative where there isn't a kind of very detailed, relatively detailed description of bodily violence, right?
Yes.
And the body is hugely important,
mm-hmm.
has been for centuries. But it comes back to that literacy issue that we talked about, right? Like, who's reading? You know? Who's paying attention? But the other thing I would say is that for me, it is important to think about bodies. I tend to refer to bodies in the plural
mm-hmm.
because I do think, especially when we talk about Black women's bodies, there is a way in which I think, you know, thinking through the differences between our bodies and how, you know, your body is going to be read differently from my body on
mm-hmm.
the street, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in various spaces. And that those differences also matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, sometimes I'm concerned that the idea of the Black body, in fact, reduces some of the kind of more nuanced dynamics of power and privilege. And, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot that comes along with with inhabiting Black bodies. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, too, the idea that, you know, there are many of us. There's a multiplicity and a complexity that language needs to be able to kind of be held accountable for.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think you already spoke a little bit about this in regards to, you know, working in a department and specifically teaching women gender and sexuality studies. And is it that you find what you teach also dictates what you've written or what you may write in the future? Because you're saying some of your larger work is looking at so many of these aspects in addition to the body and how gender and, you know, the binary aspect of it. Intersectionality, too, I'm sure. Because it really all does connect in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So do you feel like, not just in terms of the educational writing, but in your fiction specifically, that a lot of these studies are kind of dictating what your new projects may be?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, when I first started working on Blue Talk and Love, I saw it as something that was separate from my scholarship and my academic work. And I needed that. I think I needed it to be separate because it was a space where I could sort of, you know, I've always identified as a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's kind of at the core of my identity. And so it was important to me to kind of preserve that as a separate space. But as the stories developed and, you know, as time has gone on, I think, the two kinds of writing definitely inform one another. And the teaching as well, as you said, has informed my fiction. You know, in some ways, the teaching has allowed me a kind of more nuanced perspective on my fiction. I realize that when I teach, you know, Intro to Gender Studies, for example, it's always a course on women of color literature, for the most part. I mean, you know, I can't and wouldn't teach gender studies from any perspective other than, as you put it, an intersectional perspective, you know? And I realize that it's the same with my fiction, that I don't think about Black womanhood as a kind of, you know, intersection of race and gender. I'm thinking about the body. I'm thinking about, again, sort of the complexities of the inner world. I'm thinking about class location. I'm thinking about nation. I'm thinking about religion and spirituality, right? Sort of all of these, you know, sort of the complexities and the nuances of Black women's experience are very important to me. And that's what I strive to do in my fiction, is kind of really articulate the multiplicity of Black women's experiences, which is, of course, exactly what intersectionality is, you know. And I'm interested in using voice to do that. So, you know, I have characters who are just kind of like foul-mouthed, you know, 12-year-old on a train in New York. And then I've got characters who, you know, are much more kind of inward-focused and reflective and, you know.
And elements of the fantastical as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, which is really important to me because, you know, as I've said, I think what Black women and Black girls in particular, you know, I think the least, you know, understood and least celebrated aspects of Black women's experience is our imagination. And I think that has a lot to do with what we were talking about in terms of the body. The focus on Black women's bodies often comes at the expense of a focus on our imaginations and our fantasy worlds. And I think, you know, that's important to me, not only because it taps into, you know, what folks are calling Black girl joy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's very important. I think I like the term glee, personally, because for me, I feel like, you know, that part, the exuberance and the kind of the pleasure, right, that Black women experience, it's hugely important. And it's something that we don't talk about and we're not exposed to enough. But, you know, in addition, there's an intellectual dimension to that glee or that joy that is expressed in the fantasy world. And, you know, just the notion of sort of who gets to be human enough to dream. It's a really important question, and it's something that we have to kind of think about if we're going to think about a kind of effective, you know, useful, resonant Black literature. And I think Black women and Black girls need to be at the center of that conversation.
Yeah. The Black girl nerd.
Yes.
And community, which is very welcoming, I feel. Mm-hmm. Blurds, as they're also called. That's a very, to me, joyful community. And kind of gleeful. And you know, they celebrate the fantastical mainly in terms of a lot of comics, TV, pop culture. It's huge pop culture embedded area, yeah. but a lot of what is talked about in the Black girl nerd community and the Black boy nerd community mm-hmm. is the fantastical, mm-hmm. is X-Men,
right.
DC Comics, right. Marvel Comics, all these new things coming out. Marvel Girl, The
right.
Flash, Supergirl,
right.
Shonda Rhimes.
Yes. You know? Right. I love that she's on that list.
Oh, yeah, Shonda's in Shondaland. Yeah,
yeah.
Horror films. Things
yeah.
that seem unrealistic.
Yes.
Is a very big focus
yes.
of the pop culture aspects of the Black girl in their community, and
yes.
maybe that ties into the whole,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
being able to dream and dream big
exactly.
and think exuberant
exactly.
in terms of who the heroes are and
exactly.
who the villains are. And I'm using quotes when I say villains because
right.
sometimes to me it's not that black and white.
Right.
Ha ha ha. But yeah, it's like
yes.
who's good and who's bad
who's
is what makes.
Bad.
Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. And that, like, you know, having Black girl characters who are good and bad. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's the kind of complexity that we're often not afforded, again, in media nor in literature, really,
mm-hmm.
right? The burden of representation, having to be the good black girl, having to, you know, date the good black man, all of that
mm-hmm.
comes, again, at the expense of our humanity.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me, it's really important to kind of explore characters who recognize those expectations
mm-hmm.
and see all of that and eventually make the choice to say no. And to do them, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to kind of find their own ways of inhabiting their bodies and the world.
So transitioning into from that, so like I said, your debut book came out this year,
yes.
and you've had many stories, like pretty much basically every story in that
yeah.
collection was published elsewhere.
Yeah, in like earlier versions, but yeah. yeah.
So you've been, and also anthologies too, not
mm-hmm.
just Crab Orchard and all these wonderful literary magazines. So how's the process been as a debut?
Yeah.
I wonder if people, especially people like my, I don't think I do that anymore because I've talked to it and I work in publishing. But
okay.
I feel as though a lot of people fantasize.
Right.
And there's the before and after.
Right.
You know?
Yes.
Like, oh, I'm struggling. I'm so much. Emerging, aspiring is such a struggle.
Right.
And that it ends once
right.
you publish. Like,
right.
oh, once you publish, you're good.
Right.
You get the advance. You
right.
got the publisher. It's
right.
great. And your debut is with an independent press,
right.
which kind of is a big push, especially for marginalized voices,
right.
more so is that
right.
smaller independent publishers seem to recognize
right.
the importance of those voices.
Right.
So has your experience been good?
Right.
And what have you been learning? What's been eye-opening? And what advice would you give?
Mm-hmm.
to emerging artists out there in terms of what is the reality of what they should expect?
Okay. So that's a great question. I think that there's been so much about this experience that has been fantastic and really, you know, good, not only for the book and my kind of, it's been a great, enjoyable experience, but I've also learned a lot along the way. And that's hugely valuable, you know, to me too, as a writer and as someone who wants to continue to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, in terms of things that I've learned, I think that at the end of the day, you, no matter how big the advance or how big or small the press, no matter how much attention you're getting from the press, it's really important as a writer to understand your own book
mm-hmm.
and to recognize that understanding your own book means not only understanding it from your own perspective as a writer, but also understanding it from the perspectives of multiple readers
mm-hmm.
and thinking as broadly as possible about who your reader might be. So as I said before, you know, I get letters from young black women of all ages, you know, who have found me on Facebook or whatever.
Oh, that's
and just
wonderful.
It's amazing. It's absolutely incredible, right? And hearing those voices and you know, there's something so, I mean, obviously that's it's so gratifying and it's a huge part of why we do this. It, you know, in addition to that, though, in the process of preparing the book for publication, I was given the challenge to really, again, imagine, okay, so who else is my reader, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who else might get something from
mm-hmm.
this book? And that was a real struggle because for me, I kind of feel like, well, everybody should read it, you know? I mean,
yeah, that's how everyone
should, yeah.
that feels.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But then figuring out, okay, but from a kind of marketing standpoint, right, as much as uncomfortable as some of these things may be for us, we do have to be able not to think as business people, but to think as writers and artists communicating with broad audiences,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's something really useful about that. It helped me to really kind of articulate, well, these stories are about black women's sort of relationships with the body, as you said, with one another, and our experiences of kind of an underexplored and unacknowledged humanity, right? And I don't use humanity as a kind of universal term at all.
Oh, really?
No, because I think some of us are allowed to be human, some are not, you know? And when I say us, that's a very broad us, right?
The royal we.
Yeah, right. Well, except not, right? Because I don't think that Black women's humanity is, I think, you know, often undervalued and underappreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what these stories are trying to do, is really articulate a kind of, you know, again, a sensitivity, you know, in the kind of most, you know, sort of essential sense of the word, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, you know, a subjectivity and a way of kind of thinking and experiencing the world.
Yeah.
To me, that's something that, you know, is possible in fiction that is not possible necessarily in other forms of writing. And so the process of publishing really sort of called me to have to find a way to articulate that, you know, on the back of the you know, the book jacket and in interviews and in all of these different ways. So, you know, that's just to say, I think one of the things that I have learned is that at the end of the day, you know, as a writer, it's going to be largely on you to think about your book in as many ways as possible.
Yes.
And to help your publisher and whoever else is on your team to kind of figure out how to get your book to its best and its broadest audiences, if that's an objective that you have. And that, you know, that there's a joy in that. There's something, because it helps you to understand, again, what your writing is doing beyond what you thought it was doing.
Yeah.
You know? In terms of other sort of pieces of advice, I have a fantastic agent. Yeah. And that has been just, you know, being able to kind of work with someone, not only on the process of editing and kind of fine-tuning the stories, but, you know, kind of having someone who's familiar with the business end of publishing, you know, who's sort of there at every stage in the process, who can help you through that. That's, I think, invaluable. And I met my agent at the Red Loaf Writers Conference.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, I highly recommend just, you know, spending time and sometimes even the financial investment in kind of attending conferences. I met you at a writer's conference,
yeah.
Right? I mean, you know, I went through a period of really kind of investing a lot of time and energy in writers' conferences, and it's paid back manyfold, largely because, you know, of the relationships I've been able to establish and just the insight on the world of publishing. As a writer, as I said, no matter how big or small the press, you kind of have to learn a little bit about publishing in order
yes.
to make it work for you and to be kind of empowered as an artist, you know? So I recommend definitely kind of getting into that mode and mindset as early as possible. Partly too, because like you do have to find a way to separate the kind of business and from the playful creative end. And so the earlier you start with that, the better.
Yeah. Also having control over who you are in terms of representation. I've always told people at the end of the day, your name is on that book.
Yes.
And when I talk to my own authors here at my publisher, and they get frazzled or they need a little therapeutic intervention.
Right.
Don't worry, the cover is going to be good.
Right.
Don't worry, I'm going to get those typos.
Right.
That at the end of the day, I always tell them, this is your book.
Yeah.
Your name is on it.
Yeah.
I just want you to be happy with the final
product.
I think that's something that just needs to be remembered too. And it can be hard when you're a debut, and also maybe if you don't have an agent, or maybe you have an agent who is maybe not the right agent.
Right.
Because that's happened many times.
Sure.
I'm sure that so many people can tell the story of,
Oh,
I had this agent, I was so happy to get them.
Right.
And then it turns out they just weren't for me. So
right.
I had to do this all over again.
Right.
Of just knowing who you are.
Yes.
Because I've met also a couple authors where their editors said, man, if that person was 25 and they were doing this now instead of 35, I don't think they could handle it.
Right.
The backlash, the reviews, the touring, everything that comes with it.
Yes. It's a lot. It is a lot. You know, and I think part of it too is about just kind of remembering constantly that, you know, each book is a step in a process in the same way that each story is a step in a process, you know, and that, like, I don't know, I'm curious to hear about you, but I'm definitely the kind of writer that every time I look at something I've written, I think, oh, I wish I had done this, or I just want to tweak this sentence. I just want to, you know, kind of shift this image. And at a certain point, I feel like I'm coming to just sort of embrace that and actually be grateful for that, because it means that I can't get hung up on, you know, everything that I might perceive as a mistake or everything that I wish had gone differently. I'm trying to learn from each experience and kind of,
yes.
you know, move forward. And I think that that's crucial because once you publish your book, it's out there,
yes.
right? And, like, you released it to mm-hmm. the readers to get or not get, to love or not love. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, many writers have said this, and it's been helpful for me, having another project on deck once you publish
yeah.
the book is,
yeah.
I think, also really useful. I have several because I'm doing the academic writing and I've got other creative projects in mind. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, and it's great because it does help me to kind of enjoy the process of talking about Blue Talk and Love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I still enjoy reading it. I love,
oh,
you know, talking
wonderful.
To
yeah.
readers and you know, audience mm-hmm. members about it. And at the same time, I'm also excited about what's next for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's an important, you want to feel like you have a life as a writer, you know,
yeah.
and that life will be long.
Yeah.
Glad that I can say that that's the case for me.
Oh, that's fantastic
yeah.
to hear. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to say it like 5 more times to get her book, Blue Talk and Love,
Blue
immediately.
Because yeah.
you're a native New Yorker.
I am. Harlem, born and bred. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
So there you go. So she's in the neighborhood. You can get it signed.
That's right. Definitely. Or bring me to your neighborhood.
Put in requests, people.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem. So how may people reach you on social media and whatnot?
www.MeccaJamilaSullivan.com. It's MeccaJamilaH. Sullivan, SullivIvan. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, Mecca_Jamila. I think that's it. But if there's, you know, other new technologies, you'll find me there too. But yeah, definitely Facebook, the website, you know, there's a contact form in the website. So yeah, email me, holla, let me know what you think of the book. And, you know, as I said, I love to do readings. So, and I do travel often. I might
yeah.
be coming to your area anyway. So I'd love to come and see you.
So do check her website, MeccaJamilaSullivan.com, in terms of any upcoming events. And is she maybe in the New York area again? Doing more readings because you've done a good amount of readings.
It's
too,
true,
so.
Yeah, and I have a few readings coming. So I, you know, I keep my events calendar updated.
Oh, great!
So yeah, I have a few more readings. I'm doing Philly soon. I'll be back in New York in a couple of weeks. I'll be on the West Coast in April.
You'll be at AWP.
AWP. Yep. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. I'm going to South Africa in a couple of weeks, actually. So you know, if you're in Durban, holla. Yeah. Yeah, so it's been busy, but like I said, I love to travel, so I'd love to share the book.
Yeah, and also recommend it maybe to your professors.
Yes.
That's something to study in
yes.
terms of collections and the short form.
Exactly.
Perhaps, mayhaps, perhaps, maybe.
That's right. For chance. Yes, definitely.
So thanks again, Mecca, for being on the latest episode. And thank you all for listening. Minorities in Publishing is on iTunes. So if you subscribe, please do feel free to rate the podcast. I do want to give a quick plug to the new podcast, The Binder Cast, from Lee Stein and Lux Alptrom, who are the co-founders of BinderCon, which is a fantastic conference
yeah.
for women and non-gender non-conforming writers. That happens in New York and L.A. So do check that out. That's on iTunes. And I believe the first episode has Roxane Gay on it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, she's an advisory board member.
Oh,
so,
nice.
I mean, come on now. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah, no. She's the best.
And if you do follow the podcast, it is on Tumblr, I'll repeat, at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And also on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And see you, hear from you next episode. Thanks and take care.